So what I want to talk about is to try to give you a sense of how these perturbation methods can be used in finance, and in particular in this case for modeling defaults. To give you a little bit of background on what I will be doing, I will talk mainly and only on the structural approach to defaults, first passage modeling. And I will not talk at all about intensity-based modeling. So that's the first thing. I will not do that. And what I want to look at is the effect of stochastic volatility, and to show you that this has been a little bit ignored in the literature. And actually, the effect of stochastic volatility is quite interesting and producing some interesting curves. So that's what I want to explain. So. Is working. So it gives you a little bit of references. So the book that Tom was talking about is that book written with Ronny Sirka and George Papanicolaou, published in 2000. We explained this perturbation method in the context of equity in this book, and I will use the same kind of tools. This paper, I put this paper here because it has a lot of mathematics in it, combination of several scales, and so it's mathematically a little bit dense here. We have a paper on what I will be talking in the first part of the talk, which is mainly one name, the default of one name. And that paper will appear in Applied Mathematical Finance maybe this month or these days. And regarding many names, multi-names, correlation of defaults. So this is a work in progress, and the paper is not on the web yet, but it will be soon. So this is a work with my student Stephen Zhu at NC State, who defended last month. Okay, and you can find all these papers basically on my web page at UCSD. Okay, so as I said, I mean, I will be looking at the first passage model. So let me just summarize what we know in the case of constant volatility. And this goes back to Black Cox in the 70s. So this is well known, but I want to put some notation here, and so we know exactly what I'm talking about. So I'm looking at the price of a defaultable bond, and I want to make things very easy, put zero coupon, just a defaultable bond, which will pay one if it doesn't hit a barrier. I'm not going into all the details of the mechanism of the default. Simply I assimilate the price, the stock price, with the value of the firm. I'm not making any difference between these two things, and I call that X. So I have the evolution of X, which will be a diffusion in a minute, but so this is our payoff. It pays one if you didn't hit the barrier between now and maturity of the bond. Very simple thing. So of course, if X is traded by no arbitrage arguments, the price of that bond should be the expected value, the risk neutral expected value of the discounted payoff. So this is what I'm putting here. Get this part of the indicator function outside, and you are interested in this expectation. So you want to compute this expectation here. You can introduce a stopping time, which is the first time that the diffusion will hit the boundary. And what we basically are interested is in the distribution of this stopping time. Okay, so, and you can look at this as from a different point of view. This is nothing else than a barrier option. This is nothing else than a barrier option written on X, okay? So how do we solve this problem with constant volatility? Let's go back to the case where what is called the Mertens approach to default, where we don't look at early default, simply at maturity time. So there is no stopping time in this model, in this approach, and you just look at what is going on at maturity. Is the stock lower or larger than the barrier? So you have your geometric boundary motion under risk neutral. So this is a drift. We assume that the interest rate is constant. And we know how to solve this equation, obviously. And in that case, we want to price simply a European digital option, since we look at only at maturity. Either at time at maturity, XT is below B or higher than B, and that pays one or zero. And so this is called a European digital option. And we know how to solve that in the context of Black-Scholes. This is given by this nice formula where N is the usual Gaussian distribution function, and D2 is the usual D2 in the Black-Scholes formula. So this is just to put some notation here. So I will call this function UD, D for digital. So now we go to the model where we look at the everything in between now and maturity, the first passage model, and it's called the black box approach. And so this is what we want to compute. And in this case, of course, it boils down to computing the infimum of the distribution of the infimum of this process. And we know how to do that, either by PDE method or either by probabilistic method, using some transformation, like removing the drift by Gersanov. I mean, you have to play a little bit with this thing, but since we know the distribution of the infimum of one motion, then we can cook out a solution for that. Or the other way we can look at it is from the point of view of PDE. You introduce the function UTX, since we have a Markov process here, function of UTX defined like that, and that function UTX will be the solution of this boundary value problem, where you solve the Black-Scholes equation on the upper half of the space. You have a zero condition at the boundary, if you hit the boundary, and of course you have your terminal condition, which is the value of the bound at maturity. So you want to solve this problem, and again we know how to do it by what is called the method of images, which is very equivalent to computing the distribution of the minimum of the Brownian motion by probabilistic methods. So if you do that, what you end up with, so again, UD is a digital, the digital option, and then you can compute the value of the barrier, and the barrier has this premium. I mean, this you pay a little bit less because of the barrier. And we know to compute that in terms of the digital. So this is the formula given by method of images. So basically, this is to recap what we know in case of stochastic volatility. And what is nice is that we have a precise formula, I mean, an explicit formula for the price of the option. Okay, so let's see how this goes into default. Usually when you talk about default, instead of looking at the price of the bond, you want to look at the spread. And so this is what is called the yield spread. This is defined like that. So you remove the part of the constant interest rate part, and you compare your defaultable bond with a non-defaultable bond by this formula here. And so y is given simply by this negative 1 over t log of the differences here. So we have a formula in this case for the yield spread, and then we can plot this formula and see how it goes. So this is a plot of that formula. Time, so this is maturity here. These are the spreads in basis points. And so this is in log scale to see a little bit better what's going on at short maturity. That's the idea of putting log scale. So this is 1 year and this is 10 years here. And I plotted the yield spread by increasing a little bit the volatility. So you see that the first observation is that nothing is really happening for short maturity. If you look at several months here, there is no spread, basically. And this is the first contradiction with the observation. When you look at data for short maturity, like 3-4 months, of course you have spreads in the data. So this tells you already that this model is not good with that respect. Now, one idea would be, okay, let's increase the volatility to make up for some spreads. But you see, to get a little bit of action here on this part of the curve, you need to increase that to make this really big, and that then we get out of range when you want to fit that part of the yield curve at the same time. So increasing the volatility is not the answer to the question, right? So you could look at other things. For instance, you could say, okay, but here I have several parameters. I have volatility, but I have also the point where the process starts and the value of the boundary. So I could make the distance between my starting point and the boundary smaller, which is called the leverage. And actually, if you look at the plot, it's about the same thing as the effect on the yield curve is the same as increasing the volatility. So this is not either the answer to the question. The question being, let me formulate the question. The question being that, and this has been well described in this paper by Iom and Al in 2001. And they already stated correctly, I think, to get realistic yield spread, you want to increase that spread at short maturity but without overstating the associated volatility or leverage that you see. So this was illustrated in the two previous curves. So people have been working on that. I mean, and again, I'm discussing structural models. I'm not discussing at all intensity-based model or reduced form model. So some things have been done. For instance, Zhu and other people here have introduced jumps. So the idea would be instead of having this continuous diffusion, you introduce jumps. And by introducing jump, you should create some spread at short maturity because you may have a jump right at the beginning. This has some defect. I mean, this doesn't really feed the data correctly. So I won't discuss jumps here, but this has been tried and has been used, actually. Looking at interest rates, instead of having a constant interest rate, you can introduce some uncertainty in the interest rate. This has been done by long-staff Schwartz. But again, if you read this paper, they compare and give you data on data. They compare all these approaches, and the conclusion of the paper is that nobody is doing well. So you have some improvement, but it's not enough to capture the data. So, for instance, Duffy and Lando, the approach was to say, okay, actually, we don't know exactly X. The value of the firm is unknown, so let's put some uncertainty in that variable here, and that makes up for some spread at the beginning. So this is one direction of research. Another direction of research was, okay, but we don't know B either, the barrier where the default will occur, and that is part of the uncertainty, so let's put some uncertainty on B. So this is the approach taken by Kai Gizek some years ago. So, but again, I mean, this has been these models have been improvements on black cocks, but not really sufficiently to be satisfactory. So what we looked at is say, okay, why not looking at stochastic volatility and so keep the diffusion part, keep the diffusion context, but instead of having a pure geometric Bayesian motion, let's introduce some stochastic volatility. The reason is that this is one way to make your model a little bit more consistent and give some more flexibility in the model. And on the other hand, I mean, it has been clear that stochastic volatility has played a major role in other markets. So that was kind of a natural question to look at the effect of stochastic volatility on default and yield spread. So, for instance, we write here, I mean, a very sample model, and it's sample in to work with. I mean, don't pay too much attention to the details, but basically you have volatility driven by another process. And here we take an OU process. Volatility, I mean, it's well understood what means mean inverting. So OU is a very nice mean inverting process, one of the simplest diffusion, which is mean inverting. The mean is M. And is driven by another Bayesian motion, and you can correlate these two Bayesian motions. This has been very important, of course, in other contexts. So it's quite important to have this correlation, the possibility of this correlation. Then here, I mean, maybe more important for what we will be doing is the way we parameterize our OU process. This is not the usual way to parameterize your OU process. Usually, what you have here is one parameter, and we see we decouple the parameter in that way. This is simply because this OU process has an invariant distribution, and the invariant distribution is normal, and it has a mean M, and it has a standard deviation U when it's written like that. And then this invariant distribution doesn't depend on alpha. Alpha is a parameter which is a rate of mean inversion, but when you write it like that, you see that, okay, it's a rate of mean inversion because alpha is here in front of this affine drift, but alpha is also in the diffusion constant. And so you have to be careful when you move alpha. Let's say if alpha is small, alpha is large, you have to be careful that it is parameterized like that so that the invariant distribution doesn't depend on this alpha. Okay, so this is the way we do it, and now it's very legitimate to call alpha a rate of mean inversion. So my claim is that if you don't put the alpha here, you put the beta, and you call that the rate of mean inversion, somewhere there is something wrong here by doing that. But so we are careful in doing it, and then we take that as a model, for instance, and we want to look at the case where alpha will be small, alpha will be large, or in between. So the first thing is to go to risk neutral. So you change your measure. The market is incomplete since you don't trade the volatility here. So the first equation becomes our usual equation, but with stochastic volatility. And then you have a little bit of freedom here when you change your measure. And that freedom is reflected here in this market price of volatility risk. This is what parameterizes in some way the pricing measure. We make a slight small assumption is that this market price of volatility risk doesn't depend on X. This is very technical. It will help the asymptotics that we will be the perturbation that we'll be working with. So this is an assumption we make. We can generalize that, but this gets into more difficult technicalities that I don't want to deal with. So we assume that the market price of risk here depends on the on Y. Again, I mean, the point of view, and this has been our point of view since the beginning when we started using this perturbation method, is that we are not trying to find the pricing measure. The market is finding the pricing measure. So we try to write a model where there is enough flexibility to accommodate the pricing measures chosen by the market. Okay, so in, since we are in a credit market here, we assume that somewhere some CDS will be priced, and we will use this data to look at these parameters here. Okay, so this is our model under the risk neutral, and again we want to see the effect of alpha on that thing. Okay, so there is no formula, of course. If you want to price, you take this model and you want to price a barrier, there is no formula for that. So to look at the effect, what we do is simply run Monte Carlo simulation. So I will show you pictures, and then I will come back to how do we deal with the fact that we don't have a formula. So this is the what. So I will show you a sequence of pictures where I'm varying these parameters. So remember that alpha is a rate of mean reversion, and rho is a correlation between the microbial motions. Okay. So the top plot will be one realization of the volatility, just for visualizing what I mean by rate of mean reversion. It has no, it's just an example, one trajectory. And this is a spread. This is in log variable. This is in linear variable. I prefer to look at this at the middle graph, but these are the same, obviously. I really want to look at the effect on the small maturities. So here we have alpha small, meaning that the volatility is slowly mean reverting. So that means that you start from somewhere and it takes some time to go to the mean. You see it, it takes some time to go to the mean. That's exactly what the volatility is doing. And there is no correlation. The effect on the spread is basically nothing. There is no effect on the spread, or maybe a small effect at longer maturity, at 10 years here, maybe here, but nothing in the short term. And that's kind of, we can understand that. I mean, the volatility is not moving much, so the process is behaving like a geometric Brownian motion. So this can be easily understood. So if there is a correction somewhere, this will affect longer maturity, but not small maturities. So let's continue this exercise. I keep a slowly minimizing volatility, but I put a little bit of correlation. And I put a negative correlation to see what is happening. Meaning, why I put a negative correlation? Because the idea is that if volatility is increasing, if volatility is getting bigger, I want the stock to go down. So that's why I'm looking at the case of negative correlations here. So again, same conclusion. It doesn't do much. A little bit more here because of the correlation, but not much here. So that is not, that won't fix the problem. So let's see mean reversion of order 1. So that would mean that someone is putting stochastic volatility without paying attention to scales. Just you put a stochastic volatility in your model, and so we start with no correlation. So that's basically the Earl White model, right? And you do your simulation. So of course you see now it's mean reversing and it's faster. Mean reverse faster, but still of order 1. And the effect on the yield is not much here, but more effect in the middle of the curve. So if you go back to the first curve where I was looking at the effect of increasing volatility on the spread, it's about the same thing. Putting stochastic volatility in the model or increasing volatility has about the same effect. And I think this is one of the reasons that why stochastic volatility has not been really looked at, because it's a lot of trouble. I mean, in the model, a lot of, and producing even incompleteness and all this to get the same effect on the spread, which is the object of interest, than just increasing volatility. So that's explaining in some sense why stochastic volatility has been a little bit ignored here. So even if you put some leverage, it doesn't do much. And again, it's like the first effect where we were increasing volatility. Now let's increase the mean reversion. So alpha equals 10. Alpha equals 10 is not much. I mean, it's like 10. This mean it takes 1 over 10 to decorrelate. 1 over 10, that will be 1 month, right? So 1 month takes 1 month. So it's fast mean reverting, but not so fast, actually. It's fast mean reverting, but not so fast. And you see now things are, so you see first on this realization that it's fast mean reverting. You see it on the picture. But you see that there is an effect on the spread. And that is different now. Basically nothing here, but on short maturity, now you see the spread are raising. For instance, if you take, so this will be 5 months, I guess. It will be 5 months, and you get 100 basis points. This is not nothing. I mean, it's 1%. That's some spread compared to 200 basis points here. So now you see that stochastic volatility has an effect. Let me show you the next one where I put also a little bit of leverage. Same thing with leverage, so the effect is even bigger. Several observations. First, it goes to zero at very short maturity. That's because even though we have stochastic volatility, it's still a diffusion, and the stopping time is predictable. So that theory tells you that it goes to zero. The speed at when it goes to zero might be different, but it goes to zero. But still, if you look at maturities of order several months, then you have some action on the curve. So it seems that stochastic volatility is doing something on the quantity of interest. So if you continue like that, so for instance, here you have a little bit more leverage, you get even bigger effect. Of course, you are now affecting the other part of the curve. So you have to be careful, but you get your action here. This is bigger than zero, but be careful, it's not zero. It's 10 to the minus one. So at 1 month, it's already, at zero, it has to be zero. But this is not zero exactly here. And you can increase the leverage at the same thing. You can leverage small, this is leverage and leverage. Yeah, two leverages here. So let's keep this for leverage and this correlation. So small correlation and leverage of the firm. So you get some action here. And you can play with that. But let me go there. And the problem here is that, okay, this is fine. We did some Monte Carlo simulation. How do you compute with that? I mean, this is not very practical. It takes some time to do that. And it's not a practical object. That's where a perturbation methods comes in. So we see that a fast mean reversion is good. And when we have fast mean reversion, we know how to use these perturbation methods. So let me summarize in 2 or 3 minutes what are the perturbation methods and what that gives. So now we are under stochastic volatility. So if we want to price our barrier option or defaultable bond, we have to compute that object here. And since the pair XY was Markovian, we need to know the value of X and Y here at time T. And so everything is in computing this function U of T and X. So again, you could use PDE, and we like to use PDE in that case. So the PDE associated to U will solve this PDE, which is basically you have the infinitesimal generator of your XY, of your process XY, the potential or the discounting factor R, your time derivative, so this looks like Bagshaw's, except that you have stochastic volatility, so you have to put that in the equation. And so you have to solve that, the boundary condition because of the default, and the terminal condition, I didn't write one here for bond in more general option, so that will be your terminal condition at maturity. So this is your PDE, and you will solve this equation. So what you do with that, there are two issues here. Of course, you could say, I know how to solve this equation. This is not too bad. I mean, I can do it numerically. It's two dimension. I guess we can do that in some way. But the point is that you have to know all the parameters then. And there are quite a few. I mean, it's not even parametric. If you remember in our model, we have an f of y, a function of y, and this is not even parametric. Even if you give one f, and why is this one and not the other one, that is a problem. You have a problem of defining your model here. So if you define the model, if you put parameters, then you have a problem of estimation of parameter, which is not an easy one. Then eventually we could solve this equation if we have done all this. We will try to avoid all that and by using asymptotic. So using asymptotic means that I want to look at alpha goes to zero, alpha goes to infinity in this setup. So this is what the asymptotic is doing. If alpha goes to infinity, basically it's like having the volatility becoming extremely fast. So volatility will mean revert extremely fast, and then everything will be average. So you will have an effective volatility. We all know that with volatility, what counts is the integral of the square volatility. That is what counts, the integral of square volatility. Now, if volatility is fastly minverting by averaging principle or ergodic theorem, or whatever you want to call it, that integral of the square volatility will converge to a constant. And this is where this constant comes from. So basically, when alpha becomes extremely large, everything behaves like Black-Scholes with an effective volatility, which is obtained by averaging the square volatility with respect to the invariant distribution of your OU process. That is what this sigma star is, okay, the effective volatility. So here, nothing new, I mean, and nothing really interesting because we are back to Black-Scholes. What is interesting is that we can compute correction to that. So U0 is the approximation when alpha goes to infinity, and we will back a little bit and see how we can expand U in terms of alpha and compute a correction. So this is what we know to do in this case. And it turns out that the correction, we call the correction U1, so it means that the price will be approximated by U0 plus 1 over square root of alpha. Actually, it is 1 over square root of alpha, U1, and that U1 can be computed like that. So let me describe a little bit how U1 is obtained. So U1 solves the Black-Scholes equation, but with a source term. This is a small number proportional to 1 over square root of alpha. So this is small. So it's a small source, but the source is obtained by computing a third derivative of a Black-Scholes price. Okay, so this is a delta gamma. So you need the delta gamma of your Black-Scholes price to put that in the source and to solve this equation. Now, of course, you have a boundary condition. You still want zero at the boundary, and you want zero at the terminal condition because you already put the terminal condition in the leading order term. So that's how you compute your correction. Okay, so you want to compute this correction. Now, the problem is, how do you compute that? For U0, remember, if I go back, U0, I know, suppose here you have one. This is a defaultable bond. So for a defaultable bond, we have a formula. That's what the formula I gave at the beginning, the Cox-Merton formula. And here in this case, how I can compute U1? We don't have an exactly explicit solution. When we deal with European option without this boundary condition, there is a nice trick here. It's very easy to check that if I take the source and multiply by t minus t, big T minus small t, that will solve my equation. This is the solution of the equation. When you have a European option, plain vanilla European option, take the source, multiply by t minus t, that will solve the equation and the terminal condition at the same time. But when I have a boundary condition here, that trick doesn't work. It solves the equation, it solves the terminal condition, but it doesn't match the boundary condition. So you have to be a little bit more careful in the case of options. So what you do is you remove that part, which is nice in the operand case. So you remove it because we know how to compute that. You have a formula for this, so you compute all these derivatives. So you have a formula for that, and you write an equation for the difference of these two things. And the equation is now without source because you cancel the source with this term. And instead of having a source, what you get is a boundary condition. So you take your source problem and you put it in a boundary. And you know how to compute that boundary term. It's given by this formula here. You take the source at the boundary. And once you have this problem here, it's almost explicit. It's not fully explicit. It's given in terms of integral of the eating distribution of the Brownian motion. So we know how to solve that almost fully explicit. So meaning that this term is given as the Gaussian integral. So we know how to write it as a Gaussian integral. I'm not writing it. It's a topic, takes some space, but we know how to compute that up to an integral. Okay, so the situation is not too bad. So we can really approximate this price. And let me comment on the next step. When we have When we have seen at the beginning the effect of stochastic volatility, when the rate of mean reversion was slow mean reverting, it was affecting the end of the curve. So it is nice also in the model to give you this flexibility to be able to affect the left side of the curve and the right side of the curve a little bit independently. You will see on the data that it's important. So the idea, and this is something we have done also in equity, is to put two scales, two volatility factors. And if you read the literature on stochastic volatility, I think a lot of people now agree that you need at least two factors of stochastic volatility to match the data. One factor of stochastic volatility is not enough. And that's what we do here. What we do is we simply combine a fast factor, exactly what we had previously, except that alpha now is called 1 over epsilon. So epsilon is the time of decorrelation, 1 over alpha is the rate. And we put another factor, so these two factors are in the volatility, and this other factor is simply a slowly minimizing factor, where delta is a small parameter. So epsilon and delta are small parameters, are independent. You cannot even compare them, because epsilon is a time, 1 over delta is a time. So don't try to compare epsilon and delta. They don't play the same role. So this is what I'm saying here, and you can put the correlation structure that you want between your three Brownian motions. So we deal with that, and when you do that, we know how to do the same expansion. Now, this is called a singular perturbation. What I did previously is a singular perturbation, because you have a diverging term. Here, when you deal with this factor, it's a regular perturbation, and that gives you the following. So when you do the regular perturbation, basically, it's about the same thing. It goes the same way, but except that the source is not given as a delta gamma. The source is given as a vega and delta vega. So you get, by doing these two things, you get a nice combination of corrections given in terms of all the Greeks up to third three, up to order three. So this is order three. A vega is two derivative in X. It's a gamma, basically. So that's third derivative in X. So you get these two new parameters, which guide the vega and the delta vega, and you have the previous parameter from the fast factor in the delta gamma, and you put everything together, and that's what you get. So you go back to the yield curve. You're not so interested in the price. You are more interested in the yield curve. And so the yield curve is given by the leading order term, which is simply black scholes with constant volatility, and you have two corrections here, one associated with the fast factor and one associated with the slow factor. You can rewrite the yield curve as black scholes plus two corrections. And the parameters involved are simply sigma star, which is your volatility where you compute black scholes. This is the coefficient, the small parameters coming from the fast factor, and these two small parameters are coming from the slow factor. Okay? So you have a little bit more flexibility here in the model. Observe that any model I started with any F, decent F, I mean, I have to make some assumption on F, as soon as you do this asymptotic theory, you will always end up with this structure. Okay? Any model will give you the same formula in the end. Okay? So that's it, a little bit the universality of the approach here. Okay, so you can, of course, now we have formulas. We have formulas for the leading order term and the correction, and you can plot this formula. So this you see that the spread is raising at short maturity by just plotting the formula. The next step is what? Next step is calibration. Let's look at data and see how this performs. So here's an example. Here's an example. So I hope you see the colors here. Let me explain. So the data are the crosses, and the data is given by Ford in 2004, December 2004. So these are spreads. So these are maturity, and these are basis points. And you can observe that it doesn't seem to go to zero, but it's very difficult to say because you don't have data at zero at one day. You don't have a CDS at one day. So that's the data. And so the blue curve here is when you fit black cores. You take your black horse, you have a formula, and you fit your one parameter, which is the volatility, the leverage. We took the leverage from the data, actually. You can get to the leverage, or you can put it as a parameter. It doesn't really matter. So it gives you this fit, which is not good. And we knew that. I mean, this was criticized already in the paper by Yom and all this. So we know that for short, short maturity, you cannot reach these points here. And even for longer maturity, the fit is not really good. So now we input our correction, and this is what we can get here. So you see, we can fit shorter maturity. Obviously, we are not able to reach a very small one, which is 1 month and 2 months, obviously, because it's still a diffusion model. So the answer to that is, I don't know, maybe combined with GERMS, maybe combined with one of the other methods that we didn't do that yet, but that's certainly the answer you have. I don't think that there is one model who will do everything at the same time. If someone tells you that, he's a liar. And the answer is certainly you have to combine good things from very different places. That's the answer. But this is what we can achieve. Let me explain a little bit how this is working. This is interesting. How do you do that? Of course, you could make this very automatic. You can optimize, but it's interesting to understand how you do it by hand. You start with black corks here. So this is the data, and this is black corks. You bring a little bit of volatility, your V3. Your V3 is twisting the curve, is twisting the curve at short maturity. That's the effect of the V3. With V3, you twist the curve like that. It's a third derivative, so it twists the curve. Then you use the V0. The V0 is a vega. It's a vega correction. It means it just adjusts the volatility. The V0 adjusts, oh, it's called R here. That's my quarters. They change the notation in between from V to R. I hated that. But anyway. So the V0 is adjusting the volatility, but it has effect on the other side of the curve, right? And that's what it does. Once you are here, what you do is you re-twist the curve at longer maturity with the V1. The V1 is a twist of the curve. It's a third derivative. It's a delta vega at the long end of the curve. So that's what you do here. And finally, you use your sigma star, the base volatility, to readjust everything. So that's exactly how the fit is done by end waving. But this is the effect of the four parameters here. Another example. So this one is IBM 2004. Also, you see, I mean, we are missing one point at the beginning. I mean, one or two points at the beginning. That's how the model is. But you see, compared to black corks is not good at all on the data. So this is CDF, and that's where we were. And the next step, of course, oh, that's a 5 or 10 minutes. Yeah. The next step, of course, is to look at the effect of volatility on correlation of defaults, and that's one of the main problems in that business here. So let's see, for instance, if I want to look at a very, very simple thing, I take two names, and I'll look at the correlation coefficient of defaults. Okay, the very, very naive definition of correlation of defaults, and I look at that. So I do my simulation again. I simulate my model. So this is constant volatility. I see. So this is a term structure of correlation in maturity. So the blue one here is constant volatility. If I put the slow mean reverting, I look at the slow mean reverting stochastic volatility, it doesn't affect much. I mean, you see that for short maturity, the correlation coefficient is not really affected. The effect is very small. Don't really look at this because this is an artifact of the Monte Carlo. This is done by Monte Carlo. Now, let's speed up the volatility. If you speed up the volatility, alpha equals 10 again, now you get an effect on the term structure of correlation. That's exactly what we would like to see, and this is exactly what is missing in most of the models, that you cannot raise the correlation. You get a very small correlation at short maturity. So it seems that, again, for correlation, volatility is a good starting point. Okay, so instead of doing an exercise like that, let's look at the big model. So that's what we have done with this student, Stephen Zhu. And so let me spend a minute here. So we look at n names. Keep in mind, n equals 100. like Basquiat or CDO, and they all act under their own diffusion. This is under risk neutral, so I'm already under risk neutral here. Here I make a very strong assumption. My strong assumption is that these Brownian motions are independent. These Brownian motions are independent. Why I do that? It's a very technical reason, and we are working on improving that. The thing is that all this boils down to looking at distribution of heating times, right? Now, we know that when we speed up volatility, or we look even at the constant volatility case, so this will have to do with a joint distribution of heating times. But the problem of describing the joint distribution of heating times for depending Brownian motion is not easy. It has been worked out. I mean, the formula is not simple, and when you go into n names, it's a mess. So we are working on that, but for the moment, in this work, what we said is, let's try to look at the effect of correlation through stochastic volatility. So let's correlate these names through the volatility and not through their Brownian motions. So they are correlated here, but through the volatility, because they have the same factors driving the volatility. And these factors are good friends, the fast minuetting and the slow minuetting factor. So only two factors to correlate everybody. They have all the same speed, and actually when I will show you an example on CDO, I will assume that everything is homogeneous, they're all the same, all parameters, exchangeable, so I will assume that at the end. So this is what we have with the correlation structure, the most general correlation structure that you want to put in a model with constant correlation coefficient that's easier to deal with. But this is basically what we have here. And so I will go a little bit fast. So the objective, of course, is to compute the survival probability of n names. You get your n names, and you want to look at the joint survival probability. So this is the default time of name one and default time of n name. So it means that you have a big basket of large n, and then you take small n out of them, and you want the joint survival probability. So, and we make it a little bit more complex here so that the bar here is also discounted. There is a discounting in the bar here at the same time, but this is deterministic. It's a deterministic dependence in the bar here. Nothing to do with what Kai Giesecke is doing. It's simply deterministic. Okay, so again, I mean, I will skip the details, but what is nice, you can rewrite your problem. You can rewrite in terms of singular perturbation and regular perturbation here, but of course your problem is n-dimensional, and you can compute the asymptotics here. The limit is obvious. The limit will be obvious. This is effective volatility, so the volatility becomes constant. Since the Brownian motions are independent, we are in the independent case in the end. So the limit is given here. So this is at U0 here, and U0 satisfies this equation. But since the Brownian motions are independent, you see when you average this thing, this is the infinitesimal generator corresponding to independent components, so we know how to solve it. So the solution is obviously a product. You have an independent diffusion, so you get the product. And for each factor in the product, we have this formula, the formula we had at the beginning. Okay? So everything is well known at the zero level, the limit of the level. But what is nice is that we can compute using this formula, then we can compute the correction. So again, the structure is the same. The correction is given by Black-Scholes equation with a source, the appropriate boundary condition, appropriate terminal condition, and the source is given by this operator acting on U0 for which we have a formula. So at this point, you get a graduate student who knows how to compute, and you ask him to do it, and he does it. And that's what Stephen has been doing. So this I will skip that. This is a slow mediverting part. And in the end, you get your nice formula, which is here. So the leading order term is simply the product. We know that. Let's call Q the probability of survival of one term. I suppose they have the same. They are homogeneous. And you can compute the two corrections. And you see that the corrections are written in terms of polynomial of Q. And that is good. This is very good. This formula is very interesting. It's very interesting when you want to compute CDOs. One of the problems, and let me go to the next page. So we have a formula for the joint survival. Let me show you CDO. So now we assume that all the names are the same. Same in the sense they have the same parameters, they are exchangeable, right? Same starting point and everything. When you want to compute the CDO, you want the distribution of the number of defaults, right? You want the distribution of the number of defaults. Let's call L the number of defaults or loss. So you want this distribution. There is this nice formula, which is well known in probability, which gives you the, I think this is called the Poincaré formula, I'm pretty sure. Somewhere in the probability book you will find that this formula is called the Poincaré formula. But this gives you the distribution of the number of defaults in terms of the joint survival probabilities. So these are the joint survival probabilities that we computed before. So Fn is the probability that these n names survive, right? So this is given by this formula. Now, the problem is when you want to compute that, for all the Fn, if the model is not homogeneous, if it's a full model, this is complicated in terms of computational complexity, right? You think that big N is like 125 if you look at the CDX. And so there is a computational issue here. And this is extremely nice because now when you look at this approximation, now this Fn now is given by this polynomial. You approximate the Fn by doing fast minuverting and slow minuverting stochastic volatility. Now you get this polynomial in Q. So if you plug that here, that simplifies enormously this formula because each of these terms we can compute. Each of these terms we can compute, and now we are back to calculus, maybe, the level of calculus. Now this is really, you can really compute these formulas. So this is what you can do. And basically, your loss distribution has three terms, and here are the three terms. So you have explicit formulas for the loss distribution, which is great because if you do it in full generality, then you have the complexity of stochastic volatility, and on top of that, you have the computational complexity of computing the loss distribution. Okay? So, and of course, the last thing is to show what kind of loss distribution you get. So here is an example, just an example. There is no calibration here. It's an example where I took n names. Probability of survival is 0.9 for one of them. I took this one equals 0. This factor doesn't do much, but this is the important factor. And you see in blue, this is loss distribution. This is a binomial. That's the constant volatility k. They are independent. You have your binomial distribution, right? Number of defaults is binomial. And when you put your correction, your stochastic volatility correction, this is what you get. So you get these two bimodal distribution, and then you can play with that to create more tail on the right in particular. So you can play with your parameters to create the tail that you need to get the loss distribution that you want, and hopefully try to fit the tranches of your CDO. This is easy to say, much harder to do. Fitting the tranches, for some of you, maybe you have tried to fit tranches, and it's not an obvious problem. I'm not claiming that this will do it. This will solve the full problem. This has to be combined with something else, which I will keep for another time, but this really helps in fitting the tranches of your CDO, manipulating the binomial distribution. I will finish here.